plus theta sigma mu theta bar in mu plus theta square theta bar lambda plus theta square bar theta rho plus theta square theta bar square d. So where this phi psi chi chi bar f g a mu lambda rho d are fields. Okay, so they depend on x mu. And then what we showed that this most general superfield, so a general superfield is not an irreducible representation of a supersymmetry algebra, is not in irreducible. So I guess the correct statement would be a components of a general superfield. Components, right? So those fields are components of a supersymmetry multiplet. And so components of general superfield is not in irreducible representation of SUSY algebra. And we discussed that there are several ways how we can impose in a well-defined manner constraint on the superfield and get irreducible representation. And so what we started discussing is a constraint that restricts the general superfield to a chiral superfield. So a general superfield phi that satisfies this condition is called a chiral superfield. Chiral superfield. And right, so let's see. And so where this the covariant derivative is just minus del over del theta bar alpha dot minus I theta alpha sigma mu alpha alpha dot del mu. Okay? So so then we ask the question, given that what's the most general chiral superfield, how can we write it down? And the way we solve this problem by first determining chiral coordinates, right? So we looked at chiral coordinates. Chiral coordinates in the superspace, right? So those are the coordinates which are annihilated by d bar. So the chiral coordinates are just theta, right? So theta beta. And y mu is also annihilated, where y mu is just x mu plus I theta sigma mu theta bar. All right, so that's where we ended last time. And now the point was that once we figure out what are these chiral coordinates, we can write down the general solution to this equation. Okay, so the general solution phi equal to zero. So we can have an arbitrary function. This tells us that our most general superfield x mu theta alpha theta bar alpha dot is in fact a function of only two, it is only a function of chiral coordinates, phi is a function of theta and y sub mu, then that condition is automatically satisfied. So the claim was that an arbitrary chiral superfield is a function of chiral coordinates. And so if that's the case, we can do Taylor expansion. We can do Taylor expansion in theta. And So what we will find out is that our chiral superfield takes the form phi of y plus root 2 theta psi of y plus f of y. So what we have in components, we have a complex scalar. A complex scalar, and then we have a Weyl fermion, and then we have again another complex scalar, but I promised you we will see later that that's actually a non-propagating degree of freedom. So this is also a complex scalar, but it's non-dynamical. All right? So what we would like to do now is to actually build up the most general theory of chiral superfields, okay, and which will be supersymmetric. So we need to prove some statements which are sort of similar to what we've seen in the supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And the statement so what we showed that a Susi variation, if I have a chiral superfield. Well, okay, so if I start with a chiral superfield, let me write it down without saying words. So if our superfield is chiral, so it's annihilated by D bar, then the supersymmetry variation of the chiral superfield is also chiral. Okay, so once we restrict to chiral superfields, it's a consistent restriction on a level of supersymmetry. So what we want to show now, much like in the case of supersymmetric quantum mechanics, is that the supersymmetry variation of the chiral superfield the highest component. Right, so the supersymmetry variation of the chiral superfield is the highest component, of a general superfield, right? A chiral superfield is a particular example of a general superfield. So a Susi variation is the highest component, and this highest component, so the highest component of chiral superfield is a total derivative, right? So those are the logical steps as we did in quantum mechanics. And now once we did that, then we can construct our supersymmetric Lagrangians, Susi Lagrangians, by pulling out the highest component of chiral superfield, so which is just evaluated this integral. Okay, so if we have a Lagrangian of this type, then delta L Susi, the Susi variation of this Lagrangian, is total derivative. So what this implies that the action S defined over some four manifold without the boundary, or when the boundary is at infinity, d4x of L Susi is delta Susi invariant. Okay, so this is a general logic, right? So we're just gonna repeat the same steps as we did in supersymmetric quantum mechanics in a context of chiral superfields. We will evaluate the Susi variation of this chiral superfield and show, concentrate, well, okay, so I haven't been very precise here. So I guess, so we evaluate and we look at this highest component and show that the highest component is a total derivative. So it's incorrect what I said. So that is the highest component. There will be, of course, other components. And so what we do, and we concentrate on highest component. But the first thing, of course, there is a zero steps, and the zero step is actually derives this highest component of the chiral superfield. So let's do it now. So before we go, any questions? Is that clear? Is it clear as a general logic?
And that's the way how we get symmetric actions. And there will be a pleasant surprise compared to symmetric quantum mechanics. All right, guys. So
I wrote the general chiral superfield. It's up there. So the highest component is D. And so we will be looking how does D transform. So how does D of a chiral superfield transform under SUSY? Okay. So, but before, let's just see what our chiral superfield looks like. So a chiral superfield is a function of chiral coordinates, right? And once we do the expansion, it takes this form, right? So this is our y plus root 2 theta psi of y and plus theta squared f of y. And what we're going to do, we're just going to do a series, Taylor series expansion. So I have to put theta here. Phi of y is equal phi of x plus I sigma mu theta bar del mu of phi, right? So this is the first term in a Taylor series expansion. So I'm doing a Taylor series expansion. So y is x plus I theta sigma theta bar. And so I'm just doing Taylor series expansion in this shift, because I cannot have too many thetas, the expansion will terminate. So there is a first term, and the second term is just 1 over 2 factorial. And then I have I theta sigma mu theta bar, I theta sigma mu theta bar. And then I have del mu del nu of phi. Okay, and that's it. I cannot have anything else, because theta is a Weyl fermion, so it has only two independent components, so I cannot make this cube. If I have three thetas, then at least two of them will be the same, which implies that it will be identical to zero. So this is a general expansion. And so what we need to do, we just need to evaluate. So we have this piece, we just need to simplify this one. And that's where I'm gonna save some time, okay? So this is part of your homework assignment. So your homework had one of the beautiful problems. I don't think I need to erase this now yet. So the problem was the following. So there is an identity that you would need to show, which is that theta sigma mu theta bar theta sigma nu theta bar, so this guy equals to minus a half theta squared theta bar squared theta mu nu. Okay, so if we have that, then I know what that thing is, right? So this guy gives me, this combination gives me minus, because I have I squared, minus 1/2 times minus 1/2. And then I have theta squared, theta bar squared. And then I have eta mu nu, del mu phi, right? So this piece gives me a quarter theta squared with a plus sign, theta bar squared, and then I have box phi. Okay? Right, so, and I cannot simplify the first piece there. All right, so let's see. So we just expanded this term, and so our next step would be to expand that thing. So we have theta psi of y, right? So how can I write it down? So I'm going to write this down as theta alpha psi alpha of x plus I sigma mu theta bar. And then I'm just going to do again a Taylor series expansion. So this gives me theta alpha psi alpha plus I theta sigma mu theta bar. And then I have theta alpha psi alpha, and I need to act with del mu on it. Okay, I'm not writing x's. Okay, again, there will be the expansion will terminate because if I have a square of this guy, I have additional theta already here, so I will have three thetas, so it will vanish. Yes.
But it's hard for me to keep track. So this is a super field, right? So it depends on two higher coordinates. And the one down here is this component.
Yeah, so it's
the
one.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
And the same applies for the one
Oh, yeah. It's the same. So I'm just simplifying that. Yeah. Thanks. All right, so
let me stop. Are there any questions here? Good. So I'm going to use again a beautiful identity, and I'm just going to show how I'm going to use it. Right. So there is an identity that I want to use, right? So again, one of the identities that you would need to show is the following one. So it's theta phi, and then I have theta psi. Okay. So what this means? This means that you have a contraction. So phi and psi are spinors. I apologize that you have to figure out from each expression what the component it means. So in this case, phi is a spinor, psi is a spinor as well. And so this combination is just this one. So psi beta. So it turns out that you can simplify this. And so, in fact, you can write this down as minus 1/2. I'm just going to write it down. So it's phi psi, and then you have a theta squared. Okay, and there is a minus sign there. So it's minus 1/2. So if I am expanding, so it's phi alpha, psi alpha, and then theta squared. And theta squared is a standard contraction. Okay, so again, this is a homework. This is one of the problems from the homework exercise. Homework, so you would need to show this. And so what I'm gonna do now, I'm gonna do this in order to simplify this expression. See, the way why I'm saying I'm simplifying it, because notice what this expression is doing to you. So there is a different contraction of thetas, right? And I'm writing it down as a combination that involves theta squared. So I contract the Grassmann thetas with themselves and have whatever is left here. So here, what do I have? I have one theta and one other theta. And what I want to do, I want to write it down again in the same, so that I contract theta indices as well. Okay? Good. Maybe I don't need to erase this yet. All right. So let's look at this combination in some details. So I have theta theta alpha, and then I have sigma mu alpha alpha dot, right? And then I have theta bar alpha dot. And so the other one, I have theta beta del mu of psi beta. Okay? So good. So this thing equals to minus 1/2. Right? So the problem, sorry guys. So beta. So the reason is that I can get confused, okay, and we all can get confused because in the other contraction, the first term, as you can see, so we have the order matters here, right? Because if I flip the order of phi and psi, I will get an additional minus sign. So in that identity, order matters. And the important thing is that the phi will come up with an upper index, okay? So here, this is our analog of, this is one of the term, and this is the other one, right? So there will be a contraction of both of them. But this index is not very pleasant to raise or lower because that's an index of a sigma matrix. So what I can do, I can first commute them, right? Because those are bilinear. Both of them are bilinear in Grassmann variables. So this is the same as this, right? So this is theta sigma mu theta bar, okay? And now once I did this, then I know that now I can apply the formula and call this my phi spinner and call this my psi spinner. The beauty of that I don't have to raise psi. Psi will come with a lower index. So what this means that it gives me minus 1/2 theta squared, and then I have del mu psi alpha, and then I need alpha component of this guy. So that gives me sigma mu alpha dot sigma bar alpha dot. Is that clear? Well, in the second line, the contraction must be changed because I told you that in this identity, right? So in this identity, notice that those two guys, when you will be proving it, they start as having lower index. And at the end of the contraction, the one that you will write first here, and it matters because which one you write first, the sign will flip, will have an upper index. And what I am saying is that it's easier for me to declare this guy to be first. So,
So
these guys, they are Grassmann variables, they anti-commute.
Yeah, but in a product, you can just change the margin at will because you can also change the index.
Right. But then I need to, right. As long as I am. I will write down all of us as this to have the first index up. You're absolutely correct. The thing is that here, this guy, so this is one of the fermions that I will end up contracting. And this naturally has a lower index. I want to keep it to be lower index. That's why I treat them as a second fermion, because in a contraction, it will have a lower index. And that's why what I did here, of course, the answer doesn't matter. You just have to be careful. And I'm saying that that's a faster way to do it if I'm going to use that identity straightforward, right? So what I did, I first commuted that fermion bilinear with the first one, right? And now I can use directly the identity, right? So this is minus 1/2. I can write this down in this form, del psi sigma mu theta bar theta squared. Okay? All right, so very good. So you can see now why those identities that I gave as a homework, they are important. Okay, so we can now finish the expansion of the fermionic part. in the chiral superfield, right? So this gives us theta alpha psi alpha, and then I have minus I over 2, right? And I'm just copying from there. So del mu psi sigma mu theta bar theta squared, okay? So that's what will come from a fermionic term, and this is what we computed from a bosonic term. All right, so good. I think I'll keep that thing up. And let's see. So again, the best thing is just to play around with this formula so that you develop an intuition. So the last thing is that f of y. So we have a term, theta squared f of y. This is theta squared f of x plus I theta sigma theta bar, right? And now when I do Taylor series expansion, only the leading term, the first term in the Taylor series expansion will survive, because even the first term will give me three thetas, right? So it will not be there. So that's the same as theta squared f of x. Okay, so so on the blackboard up there is a general most general expression for a superfield. We looked at a chiral superfield, and we can write down, we can now assemble all the pieces and write down chiral superfield in the form of the general superfield, x mu theta alpha dot bar. So it will take this form. So it's phi of x. Okay, so I'm not gonna write down. So everything after here depends on x. Depends on x mu, right? And I'm just doing, I'm just assembling pieces which are expansions in theta and theta bar. So there is phi here plus I theta sigma mu theta bar del mu phi plus a quarter theta squared theta bar squared box phi, and then plus root 2 psi minus I over root 2 theta squared del mu psi sigma mu theta bar, and plus theta squared f. Okay, so now you can see that if you compare the chiral superfield with the most general superfield, indeed there are some higher spin components that arise in the expansion of the chiral superfield, but they are not independent, right? So in particular, the vector component is not an independent vector, but it's just a gradient of a scalar. And that's a way how constraining general superfields, you will get some irreducible representation. In our case, this chiral superfield. So, but the important thing again, which again follows just from this, so this is spin zero, this is spin zero state, this is spin one half state. So it's just there, the multiplet structure, the supersymmetry, irreducible multiplet structure of the supersymmetry algebra. So as before, what we will find out later today is that this is not dynamical. Is not dynamical. Okay. So, good. Let's move on. All right. So, let me just mention a few words about anti-chiral. Right. So everything that we said about chiral can be extended to anti-chiral with obvious changes. So let me just outline that. So when we talk about anti-chiral superfields, okay, So the antichiral superfields will be the ones that are annihilated by the alpha covariant derivative. And so we can solve this in all generality. So an antichiral superfield will be a function of antichiral coordinates. So here this d alpha, let me remind you, is del over del theta alpha plus I sigma mu alpha alpha dot theta bar alpha dot del mu. And so theta bar is theta bar, and then antichiral coordinate y is just x mu minus I theta sigma mu theta bar. So you can first again show that those are indeed solve the antichiral constraint. D alpha on theta bar equals to zero. D alpha on y equals to zero. That's why that's the most general form of the superfield. Right. Now, good. So the last comment is that chiral superfields and antichiral superfields form rings, form algebraic rings. What this means? This means that if we take one chiral superfield phi 1, and if we multiply it by another chiral superfield, a product of two chiral superfields is a chiral superfield. So let me make the statement as follows. So if phi 1 and phi 2 are chiral superfields, then the product of them is chiral as well, is a chiral superfield. And that's a clear statement, right? Because whether you are chiral or not is the question whether you are being annihilated by d alpha, and d alpha is a linearly acted differential operator. So this guy, so is just phi 1 d alpha bar of phi 2 plus d alpha bar dot, so I need to keep dots here, of phi 1 times phi 2. And if each of the fields was chiral before, then this thing will be zero, right? So there is no subtlety with anti-commutators, because whenever we move d bar across components of phi, we will always have an even number of Grassmann coordinates, right? So there is no extra minus signs being picked up, so nothing funny happens. So we can just commute a superfield with a d bar. Okay, so the same holds. Holds for antichiral superfields. They also form a ring. So if phi 1 bar and phi 2 bar are antichiral superfields, then phi 1, phi 2, the product of them is antichiral superfield as well. However, and this is an exercise you can do, or it's very straightforward. I'm not going to talk about this in class. So if you take a chiral superfield phi and an antichiral one, okay, so phi is chiral, so we're assuming that d bar alpha phi equals to zero, and d alpha of phi bar equals to zero. One is chiral, so this is chiral superfield, and this guy is antichiral superfield. Then this guy, so this is a, it's a superfield, right? Is a superfield again, it's just a statement that if you have two functions defined on a superspace, if you multiply them, you will get a function defined on a superspace. So it will be a superfield, but it's neither chiral nor anti-chiral. So you can check that d alpha dot bar of phi phi bar is not equal to zero, and the same is d alpha of phi phi bar is not equal to zero. So meaning that so it will not form an irreducible representation. If you multiply chiral and anti-chiral superfields, it's no longer irreducible representation of a supersymmetry algebra. So this actually will be very important for us later when we'll study non-perturbative supersymmetry. That so you can think of the things that will play a huge role is the idea of holomorphicity in non-perturbative supersymmetry. So holomorphicity means that we have a functions that depend on Z, where Z is a complex variable, and not on the Z bar. So you can think of a chiral superfield as a holomorphic coordinate, Z. And so any combination, any polynomials and the infinite series of chiral superfields will be a chiral superfield. And similarly, you can think about anti-chiral superfield as an anti-holomorphic variable, as a Z bar. And so the functions that we will be writing, functions relevant for a chiral superfield, will be a holomorphic function, and the functions that for the anti-chiral superfields will be anti-holomorphic function. And so one of the things that allow to solve various supersymmetric models is that a complex analysis is usually much more constrained, so that's what in particular Zyberg was exploiting when he was proving various theorems and establishing some rigorous non-perturbative results in supersymmetric gauge theories. All right, guys? Good, good. Okay. So we are done with the first step of our, do I have those steps still somewhere? Sort of our plans that we had to do. Okay, so I think I erased it. So anyway, so what we will proceed now, we will study a supersymmetry variation of chiral superfields. Much like we did in the supersymmetric quantum mechanics, we will show that the highest component of the chiral superfield is a total derivative, okay? So, and that, as you remember, that will be a step towards writing down the most general supersymmetry preserving Lagrangians. So, going to Lagrangians, all right. Well, first of all, let's recall our supersymmetry variations. So those supersymmetry variations, they are generated by two differential operators, which are translations along the Grassmann path of the superspace. So they are given by this minus I sigma mu alpha alpha dot theta bar alpha dot del mu, and then we have q alpha dot bar. And this is minus del over del theta alpha bar dot plus I sigma mu alpha alpha dot del mu. And so if we have a general superfield, so the way how we define a supersymmetry variation, so that was by definition, yes? Yeah, so what I did is that I made a typo. So this guy is on this side, right? Thanks. Yeah. So, so a definition was that given a general superfield, our supersymmetry transformation takes this form plus psi bar q bar, okay, acted on phi. And in components, this is psi alpha q alpha minus psi bar alpha dot q bar alpha dot, okay, phi bar. And the reason why I wrote a minus sign, because we define q and q bar with the lower indices, and in a contraction here, so with a plus sign, our contraction convention was this. Okay, and since I want to use q bar with a lower dotted index, so I had to flip a sign. All right, so very good. So actually the statement I'm going to make is a general statement. So we'll make it a statement for any superfield, okay? So not only just chiral or anti-chiral, just because, I'm not buying anything for myself by restricting the arguments. So let's see. Good. So we need to compute psi alpha, right? And then I have del over del theta alpha. So the highest component of the superfield is D, and I want to know how does D change under the supersymmetry variation. Okay? So the first step, find find delta susi of D equals something. So we want to show that the highest component of any superfield is a total derivative, okay? And so let's do that. So it's minus I sigma mu alpha alpha dot theta bar alpha dot del mu, okay? And then, so that's psi q, and then there is psi bar q bar. So I have alpha dot here, and then minus del over del alpha dot, and then I have plus I theta alpha sigma mu alpha alpha dot del mu, okay? So this differential operator must act on our superfield, so it acts on that guy, theta psi plus theta bar psi bar plus theta squared f theta bar squared g plus theta sigma mu theta bar a mu plus theta squared theta bar lambda bar plus rho plus theta squared theta bar squared d. Okay? So that once we compute this, so what we are finding a SUSY variation of a general superfield is given by this expression. And it will take tons of terms, as you can see. So there are lots of complicated terms. But the ones that we will be interested in, because ultimately we want to know how the highest component transform. So there will be all terms in there that will have a small number of thetas. And then what we need to do is to look at the highest term there, okay? And so where this question mark is something that we need to evaluate, okay? So because whatever it is in there, that's the way how our highest component, the D component, will transform. Is that clear? Good. So let's see. So our differential operator contain derivatives with respect to theta. Derivatives with respect to theta can only decrease the number of theta parameters. So they will never lead to a highest component. So we can forget about them. So for the terms that we are interested in, they will not contribute. So the only contribution will come from this guy and from this guy. So because the first term, so you look, the first term has theta bar. So the term that will contribute is the one that has already three thetas. And so for this one, the non-trivial contribution will come from this term. And for the one here, okay, so this has theta, so I need theta bar squared, theta term, so the contribution will come from this. So those are the only two terms, and they will contribute in this manner, that will contribute to their highest component. There will be, again, other terms, but we don't care about them. We just concentrate at the highest component of the superfield. All right, is that clear? Very straightforward, right? So let's do this exercise. All right. So let's look first at this. So we have minus I sigma mu. Okay, so let me have minus psi alpha sigma mu alpha dot theta bar, and then I have del mu of theta squared theta bar lambda bar. Okay, that's one. And then the other one is minus I psi bar alpha dot, and then I have theta alpha sigma mu alpha dot. And then we have del mu that acts on theta bar squared theta and rho. Okay, is that clear that, first of all, without me doing any computation, is it clear that it's a total derivative? Right, because look, guys, what we have a Grassmann coordinate, and there are four of them, and I act with a total derivative del mu on fermion in both cases. So those are total derivative terms, right? But let's just simplify them. So again, as I'm saying, is that we don't need to do that, but well, let's just practice. So simplify those terms. So how we can simplify this? Well, again, what we can do, we can look at the first thing, right? So the first term I can write down as psi, right? Psi with sigma mu theta bar, okay? And it's been multiplied No, that's not the way how I wanna look at that term. First of all, there is an alpha dot there. Okay, so So this guy is minus I, right? And I can pull out theta squared. So then what I will have? I will have psi sigma mu, okay? I contracted alpha index, so I have a lower index here. And then I contracted with theta bar with an upper index, okay? Times, then I have I can anti-commute those two things, right? So if I anti-commute, I will get a plus sign, and then I can write it down as lambda bar with a lower index and beta and the beta dot index there. Okay, and then there is this other term that I will not write down, because the manipulation you will end up doing with that one is the same as with the first one. So is that clear what I did? Oh, I just missed it. It's del mu. Sorry, thank you. Okay, good. And so now here comes another identity. And I put it in exactly the form that we can use this identity from homework. Okay. So that identity is following. So it says that theta bar phi bar, like theta bar psi bar equals to minus 1/2 phi bar psi bar theta bar squared. Okay? Well, this is exactly the same as this, right? Well, by the way, there is no sign change here because, as you pointed out correctly, once we switch, there is no sign flip as long as I use contraction conventions. So you are right. So there is the minus stays here unchanged. So this is minus 1/2 phi bar psi bar theta bar squared. Okay, and so now you can see that we put things in exactly the form where we can use this identity. So if I combine those things, so what I will have? I will have minus I theta squared. That's what I had before. And now this guy will play the role of the of the first term there. So this is going to be psi alpha sigma mu alpha alpha dot, right? So, and it will come in a convention with a lower index. Now, the next guy here in a convention, in the summation convention, must have an upper index. Okay? And it will be the same index because we are contracting those two things. And I need to multiply it by theta bar squared and divide by minus 2. Okay, that's this minus 1/2. So altogether, I have I over 2 theta squared theta bar squared, and then I have a contraction psi sigma mu del mu lambda bar. Okay? And let me check. All right, so very good. And the same with the other term. Okay. So indeed, as I was promising you, it's a total derivative. Well, it was obvious from there. Okay, very good. So what we showed, let me just do this. So what we showed the following fact, that if we do a Soucy variation of a D term, we can write down this Soucy variation as del mu of something. Okay, so that's what I mean by a total derivative. And so now this tells me that if I construct an action, so if I write down the action at D4x, of the highest component of a superfield, right? So this is action. Then the Soucy variation, if I do a supersymmetry variation of our action, right? So it will be an integral over d4x of the Soucy variation of the D term of that superfield, and we showed that for any superfield, the supersymmetry variation of the highest component is a total derivative, so it's del mu of something, And so if this is an integral over a four manifold, right, then I can use a Gauss law theorem to rewrite this as an integral over the boundary of this manifold of whatever I have there. And the assumptions that we always do in our quantum field theories is that either we look at the manifolds that do not have boundaries, or our fields die sufficiently fast so that in any way the integral over the boundary of our fields always vanishing. So that gives us a very simple way how we can construct supersymmetric actions. We just write down an arbitrary function on a superspace that will be a superfield, extract the highest component of that superfield, and that will automatically give a supersymmetry invariant action. Okay, exactly the same as we did in the case of quantum mechanics. So how do we, much like in the case of quantum mechanics, this procedure of extracting the highest component can be represented as extending the bosonic integration in space to a superspace integration over Grassmann coordinates. Okay, so that's what I want to discuss right now. D for theta, which is d squared theta bar. And let me give you some definition what I mean by that. So this is d squared theta is a one quarter, epsilon alpha beta, del over del theta alpha, del over del theta beta. And d2 theta bar is a quarter alpha dot beta dot, except that, sorry, here I have to use lower indices, okay? Del over del theta bar alpha dot, del over del theta bar beta dot. So that's the way how I define d2 theta and d2 theta bar. And so what I have to show to you, so we will show prove some simple integration formulas. So what we do, let's compute 4 times the integral of theta squared. So let's evaluate this integral. Okay, so according to a definition, what do I mean by d2 theta? It's a quarter of that stuff, so which means that a quarter and a 4 will cancel. So I have epsilon alpha beta, del over del theta alpha, del over del theta beta, right? What I have, I can write down. So I have acted on theta squared, but I can write down theta squared as alpha 1, theta alpha 2, and I need to bring down this alpha 2 index. So it will be alpha 1, alpha 2. So I'm just doing this once so that you can see it's a straightforward, though a bit tedious, exercise to compute this Grassmann integral. So, and you know, if you are careful, then you are all right. So we have 2 epsilons, so let me keep it here, epsilon alpha beta, epsilon alpha 1, alpha 2. Now I have 2 derivatives with respect to thetas, acting on 2 thetas. So there are 2 ways how I can do it. So I can act with a derivative on the first coordinate, okay? And then the other one will automatically act on the second one. So the first will give me canonical symbol alpha 1 beta. The second one will give me canonical symbol alpha 2 alpha. Or there will be additional term when I act with the first derivative on a second theta parameter. If I do that, I need to move it past the first one, so which gives me a minus sign. Okay? And then I have this guy, derivative with respect to theta beta, that's a canonical alpha 2 beta. And the remaining one, I don't have to anti-commute anything. It will act directly on that one. So it gives me canonical alpha 1 and alpha. Okay, so and the rest is just a simple exercise in tensor analysis. So we have epsilon tensor and we have canonical tensors. So if you do the algebra correctly, you will find out that that's equal to 4. I mean, just do the contract. All the indices are contracted, so so you find out that that's 4. So what this means that integral d2 theta of theta squared equals to 1. So we proved this. And so similarly, we can show that integral d2 theta bar of theta bar squared also equals to 1, with all the definition, including that funny 1/4. And that's it. So that's it because, let's see. No, let's do it. I think I should get 4. I could be wrong, of course, but let's just see what we have. But then I was doing it late yesterday, so anything can happen. All right, so what I had here is, so the first epsilon alpha beta, right, I have unchanged. And then I have alpha 1 is beta, so it's epsilon beta alpha times 2, right? So, and that's equal to... So this is minus 2 epsilon alpha beta, but the one with lower and upper indices, they have a minus sign. So you have plus, sorry, you have minus 2 times minus 2 plus 4. All right, very good. So what this tells us that the D term, in order to get the D term from a any superfield, all I have to do, I just have to perform this Grassmann integral, okay? So that gives me a D term. And for example, it's for example, for a chiral superfield, right? So for a chiral superfield. For a chiral superfield, if you remember the D term, chiral superfield, so phi of theta and y was equal plus 1/4 theta, theta squared, theta bar squared, and then I have a box of phi. So if I were to take a chiral superfield do this exercise, then I will get that the D term equals to 1/4 box phi. And so what this tells me is that my supersymmetric action, if I were to look only at chiral superfields, so it would be an integral d4 of d, for the chiral superfield. So it's 1/4 integral over d4x of box phi, and it's equal to 0. So what this tells us is that we cannot construct nice actions if we just look at the chiral superfields, okay? So we need to we need to do something better than that. And something better is doing the following thing. So the claim is that we can construct. So first of all, is it clear that once I have a superfield, I extract the decomponent of that superfield by doing Grassmann integration, I will get a supersymmetric action, right? Good. And we just showed that we cannot leave just with a chiral superfield, because in that case, we don't get any action at all. We just get boundary terms. So how we can get something interesting? And the answer to that question is very simple. Well, don't look only at chiral superfields. So what we need to get something, not even interesting, but just to get something at all, we need both chiral superfields and anti-chiral superfields. And so in fact, we can start constructing our supersymmetric actions by specifying a most general function of chiral and anti-chiral superfields. So index I, in principle, it can be a different set of indices. So we have I and J. And so this function is known. So this function K is a Keller potential. Has a name, and it's a Keller potential in supersymmetric field series. And so what we learned that if you give me a Keller potential, I can construct you a supersymmetric Lagrangian just by evaluating the highest component of this Keller potential. So evaluating d4 theta integral of k. Okay? So this is automatically SUSY invariant. Right? So what I want to point out is that the Keller potential is not uniquely defined. What I mean by that is that different Keller potentials, and that has interesting implications, but the statement is that different K can lead to the same Lagrangian. Okay, so it will be completely different looking functions, but once you evaluate a supersymmetry preserving Lagrangian, you will find out that it's the same. And so the simplest example, well, I don't know if it's the simplest, that's the one that I know. So if we look at the Keller potential, and we modify it, we will go to a new Keller potential, which is the old one, plus an arbitrary function just of chiral superfields, plus some other function, g, of anti-chiral superfields, only of anti-chiral superfields. Okay, so this is a function of chiral superfields, and this is a function of anti-chiral superfields. So the claim is that since those are arbitrary functions, of course the Keller potential will look different, but it's also clear that the Lagrangian will be the same. The reason for that is that Lagrangian will go into whatever you had before, plus that guy is an integral over d4 theta of the d term of the chiral superfield. any function of chiral superfields will be a chiral superfield, right? So much like we discussed before, by any function, what I do mean by that is that something that has a nice Taylor series expansion around some point in the space of fields. So plus there will be additional contribution from anti-chiral part, right? But then we show that this guy is a total, both this guy and this guy are total derivatives. So the reason for that is that the D term of a chiral superfield, we just evaluated it there, it's a total derivative, it's a box phi. And the same is true for anti-chiral superfield. So so by changing a Keller potential in this way, what we are doing, we are modifying our Lagrangian by total derivative terms. And so that will not affect the dynamics of a theory in any way. All right, so very good. So now what is fun to do is to actually look the simplest function. Okay, let's try to get the simplest function and look what field theory we will get for the simplest scalar potential, if you wish. So we already know that we cannot leave just, yes?
To the striking, but what has the Keller potential to do with Keller geometry?
It has very simple, very close.
And I will mention some. No, it is rigorous. There is a Keller geometry, and if we will have time in this course, and then we will learn even what is a hyper-Keller. So that will be a Keller potential of extended supersymmetric model. It does have, so it's the same as a Keller geometry. So if I have time, I don't think I will have, I wanted to finish it today, but it doesn't look like I will have time. So this guy, you can think of as, so when you talk about a Keller geometry, you mean that there is a manifold. There are some coordinates in that manifold that vary. And then there is a single function that determines you pretty much the geometrical properties of that manifold, like metric and all other things. So think of this, the coordinates are just fields, right? So because those are scalar, those are our scalar fields. So think of this just as a coordinates on a manifold. And so that K has exactly the same meaning. So we will have a complex manifold. Moreover, it will be a Keller manifold. And that function will determine for us, much like a Keller potential for a Keller geometry, the properties of the configuration space of the scalar fields. So we will come to that later today. Not today. I'm too optimistic for today. All right, guys. So let's see. So for now, it's just a name. And if you never heard about Keller geometry, that's fine. Unfortunately, you will not learn much in this course about that, because I'm not gonna use spend a lot of time on this nonlinear sigma model, which leads to that. So anyway. So we try to look at the example, okay? There's some simplest example. And so the model is specified, as you can see, by completely specifying, a function of chiral and anti-chiral superfields. And the simplest function that we can imagine, so it must be something that contain both chiral and anti-chiral, is phi phi bar. Okay, so that's what we have. So that's the simplest Keller potential imaginable. And so let's try to figure out what the theory corresponds to that. So phi is a chiral superfield, and this one is an anti-chiral superfield. And first of all, it's clear that order doesn't matter. Is it clear? Phi and phi bar will commute with itself. Because in the expansions, there are always even powers of Grassmann thetas here and here, and so they will commute through each other. All right, so very good. So let's start doing the computation. Again, it's very straightforward. So so what we did earlier today, we wrote the theta expansion of a chiral superfield. So I'm just gonna remind you what that was. Del mu of phi plus a quarter theta squared theta bar squared. And I'm going to remind you that because we need, once we evaluate this Keller potential, we need a highest component of this Keller potential. We need to evaluate it. That's what will give for us the supersymmetric action corresponding to that Keller potential. So I have box 5 here, and then I have plus root 2 theta psi, and then I have minus I over root 2 theta squared del mu psi sigma mu theta bar plus theta squared f. Okay, so that's the first term, that's phi, and then I need to do phi bar. And so when I do phi bar, then the scalar will be a complex scalar. Now, this will give me minus. This will give me minus. Now, if you are careful with sigma theta, sigma mu theta bar, you will find out that that's a Hermitian combination. Doesn't change. Phi. So that guy doesn't change as well, except that I have phi bar. Box phi bar. Then this guy also doesn't change. Doesn't change the sign. So I'm just taking a complex conjugate of the expression before, and then I have plus I over root 2 theta bar squared, and then I have, theta sigma mu del mu of psi, and then plus theta bar squared f bar. Okay? So, let me finish this so that we can move on next time and I don't spend time writing it again. Okay. Do you guys allow me to skip the multiplication? So I gave you the general rules how you operate, right? For example, we're going to pick up this component so you can see that this is a term that I will be picking up, right, for example. Then the other terms that I will be picking up is this one and this one. This will give me also four thetas, two thetas and two thetas bar. And then I can use, well, first of all, I need to change the summation index here so that it's different from that one. But then I can use some of the identities that you are asked to prove in your homework assignment to simplify those terms. And I can go through all the terms and collect theta squared, theta bar squared terms. And if I do just that, let's see. Can I skip that, guys? Is that all right? We can get more progress if you let me skip things like that. All right, good. So if we do all that, I'm just going to write down the answer. 66. So if I take this Keller potential, which is phi bar, and I look at theta squared, theta bar squared term, and what I will find out is this, minus del phi bar, okay? And then I have plus I, del mu, psi bar, sigma bar mu, psi, and plus FF bar. Okay, so what I mean here, this is just del phi bar, this is just del mu phi bar, okay? Now, another thing that you see here is that you see sigma bar mu, so del mu psi bar sigma bar mu psi. So what this is del mu psi bar with index alpha dot, sigma bar mu alpha dot alpha psi alpha. So, and that sigma bar with raised indices are the normal sigma mu, where I raise the indices using epsilon mu and mu. Yes? Okay, so let's we have 4 minutes, so let's look at the if I can convince you about this, then you will believe the rest. Okay? I'll come back to your question. So let's see where we have pieces of phi, right? So we have this guy. Will be multiplied by phi bar, right? So I have, I don't want to make any mistakes. Right, so there will be a term, term here, phi bar, right? Except that it will be with a coefficient a quarter. Then there will be a term of this guy, right? Which is just a complex conjugate. So, and then there will be this term, right? So this term you need to use this identity, right, which is in your homework, so it's minus eta squared minus 1/2 theta bar squared eta mu nu. And so clear that if you do that, then you will have del phi. Okay, so let's look at the coefficient. So you have I and minus I, that gives you plus, but then there is this minus 1 in front. So this will be minus 1/2 del phi bar, right? So the type of gymnastics, let's see, 65, 66, did I do it right? So the type, so now I can differentiate this by path, integrate this by path, and this gives me minus a quarter del phi bar, this gives me a quarter, and then I have minus 1/2, this gives me minus 1. This one is a little bit more tricky. I mean, it's straightforward. So once you do the algebra, you will see that I can put it in this way, and I check that the signs are correct. And moreover, it agrees with Schwarzenberger. Yes?
So yes, so F is ZF, and you can see that the only place where F enters
in the highest, when this guy, I multiply by this. Okay? And complex conjugate, yes. So here, what I want to point out, so here we have a complex scalar, this is a Weyl fermion, but this is non-dynamical field, right? Because the equation of motion for this field, right, so is just gives me F equals zero, F bar equals to zero. And the field enters quadratically, so much like in quantum mechanics, I can replace in a path integral exactly it with equations of motion. So this is zero, so I can just drop it out. Okay. So what we see, okay, let me summarize what we found, and that's where I promised you there will be something special compared to quantum mechanics. Remember, in quantum mechanics, we had problems to build in kinetic terms. What we have now, we have a different type of problems. It looks like that the only thing, if we use a Keller potential, the only thing that we can do is to build derivative interactions. We can build a kinetic term. So in fact, the simplest Keller potential give rise to a free theory of a complex scalar and a free theory of a Weyl fermion. We cannot build in interactions. Okay? So we cannot build non-derivative interactions. So the next lecture, which will be next week, we will discuss how do we introduce interaction. And so we will learn a new aspect of supersymmetric field theory jargon. So there is a Keller potential, and then there is a superpotential. So we will learn what the superpotential is, and how does it leads to introducing interactions in Fuchs field theories. And then we know everything about Fuchs. All right, guys. Next week.